The wrap. It was only a small paper. I think we were earning take-home pay after all expenses, and it was an independent thing. And we were housed within the Buff office, which by this point had moved to downtown Halifax, Garnton Street, with the new leadership. And so we had a free office space, free computer to use. But everything else was up to us. So we had to sell advertising. And I think, I forget now all the numbers involved in it, but we would run 7,000 copies, but only once a month, 8 pages, and we endeavored to cover all the news that we felt was important for the community. And that was actually defined pretty broadly. Like, yes, the focus was the Black community, but, and around the province, not just in Halifax, but at the same time, we were also a North End paper. We were a paper out of the North End Halifax. So there was some touching on general North End things, problems and issues and so on. And certainly, one of the stories we broke did not just have an impact for Black people in Halifax, but for anybody who's living in public housing. It was one of the big stories that we broke that nobody else could get at. Nobody else. I'm happy with this. I'm sorry about the situation that we ended up breaking. And I had a headache. I was worried I was going to get sued. I mean, it was really... But anyway, to make the point, we ended up breaking a story that actually we didn't do enough with, and it was about how Halifax Housing Authority employees, public housing employees, were coercing young women into providing them with sexual favors for things like tape recorders and stuff like that. And this was a story, the CBC, I found out later on, I've been trying to get the story. They couldn't get it confirmed. There's nothing they could do. And I stumbled on it by accident. I called up one of my sources and just asked, and just told her out of the blue, thinking about something else, completely different. I didn't even know about this. I just said, I know all about it. She said, how'd you find out? It was one of those stupidest things. I meant something completely, you know, like almost boring pedestrian story I was thinking about. And then she ended up telling me about this incident because she was involved with public housing. And which had been kept hush hush. The guys who had been involved had been fired. No criminal charges, though. So I got a story from her. I never got a real confirmation from Halifax Housing, but I got enough to actually put on a front page story on it. And so I scooped everybody. Or we scooped everybody in Halifax with the story. And then I got another call from the Daily News to come and work for them, to come and be a reporter for them. And so. But again, it was one of these weird things. At the same time, I got the call from the Daily News to go and work for them. I got a call from the office of Howard McCurdy, MP, whose community or communications person had decided to resign to take another job within the NDP, federal. And he had told her, apparently, I got to know Howard later, so this makes sense, but she took him literally when he said, I want you to contact every newspaper in the country and find somebody to replace you. He didn't know, he hadn't remembered me specifically. I'd first met him back in 79 in Toronto. I got on the train and came up for the last meeting of the National Black Coalition of Canada. I just came spontaneously, just jumped on the train in Halifax and came up because it was something going on. I wanted to be part of it. So that's why I met Howard for the first time. But he wasn't thinking of me. He just said to his assistant at that point, her name was Susan Seville, contact every paper. And she did. Including mine. And so I'm sitting there and I can't believe it. I said, what? Howard McCurdy's office? You're calling me? My little paper? I only come up once a month. And she was saying, yeah, well, you know, Howard said he wanted me to call every paper in the country. So you're on the line. So I said, okay, what am I supposed to do? She said, okay, here's what we need. CV, blah, 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 blah. So I sat down, wrote a letter, put the CV together and sent it off. 2 days later, I get a call from Howard. And he interviewed me over the phone and said, how soon can you start? So I said, well, I got to close my paper down and come to Ottawa. So he gave me a few weeks, and I shut down the paper and moved to Ottawa. Actually, I didn't shut it down. I gave it to Mark Day, who was my advertising manager, and Charles Saunders, who actually, I've got to digress here and talk about Charles Saunders for a moment, because Charlie, I shouldn't call him that. He always goes by Charles. Charles is Black American, and he came to Canada to escape the draft. In 1970, he arrived just in time for the War Measures Act. I always liked that.
You thought you were running away from oppression.
And he was also a writer. a sci-fi writer, since he was, he still is. And he published three fantasy series novels with Da out of New York, the Imero series, an African superhero, fantasy superhero type guy. Like this almost sounds like an oxymoron, but kind of Black Tarzan figure. That's what he created. And he was well known in fantasy writing circles for that work. And for that genre work. And he also had a movie developed, he had a screenplay and a radio play done. And he'd been living in Ottawa. It was funny, he and I switched places. It was really weird. He'd been living in Ottawa for 17 years. Not quite 17, or 15 years or so. He'd been living in Ottawa 15 years. And he'd met some Black Nova Scotians, he'd heard about the Black community in Halifax. But then the sci-fi group, the people who do the Hugo Awards, they had a meeting in Halifax. So Halifax is a real strong sci-fi community. And Charles went down to Halifax for the first time, 85. Excuse me. He got there, he met people in the Black community, and he felt like he was at home because it reminded him of his boyhood in Philadelphia, where there was, of course, a much larger Black community, but just the way people speak, the culture, the church, and all that, it reminded him of Black America. So he came back to, another guy does things on impulse. He came back to Ottawa, packed up his bags, and moved to Halifax, lock, stock, and barrel. And decided this is going to be my new home community. And within a year of getting there, he married a Black Nova Scotian woman, Dale Farmer, and started doing, was still doing some writing, freelance writing, trying to make a go of it. He got a few things done, the movie, which actually got made in Argentina with an all-white cast. But still, hey, it got made. He tried to get a few other projects going, but they didn't quite pan out. And he did the radio play on a Black boxer, because one of his big interests was sports, and pugilists especially. And he eventually did a book on Black Canadian boxers. In any event, it was really good. He and I would meet from time to time, too, because he was really, really into writing as well once I got back there in 85. In fact, I met Charles shortly after I moved back to Nova Scotia and moved back to Halifax in 85. There's a little Black newspaper running then. The guy who actually was my cousin, Percy Paris, and the paper, forgetting what it was, I think it was called the Black Journal or something like that, or Provincial Monitor maybe. I can't remember for sure, but he had this little paper going. He was really struggling with it. It wasn't working out very well. So I went to see him to get a job. And of course, he didn't have a job to give me, but he was very supportive. And he introduced me to Charles, because Charles was sitting there trying to get a job. With his little storefront office on Goddard Street in Halifax. And Percy was great, because he gave me a key to his office and said, come in, use the typewriters anytime you want to. Right? So it was like, okay. I used to go in there many late nights and just do some typing. But anyway, that's when I first met Charles. And so then Charles took over the rap when I left in 1987, and he ran it with Mark Day for about, I guess, 8 or 9 more months, 5 or 6 more issues. And then it just collapsed, or they closed it down or stopped working on it. I don't know what for sure. But Charles now, or has been since 1989, I guess it's been. Yeah, since 1989, he's now been a columnist with the Halifax Daily News, the paper that tried to hire me. Ended up basically hiring Charles as a columnist. But that was based on, partly on the work he did with the rap. And so, I mean, this is it's really nice. He still does it. He's a great columnist. He sends me, every couple months, he sends me a whack of his newest columns. And that keeps me up to date with what's going on in Nova Scotia. And he's also working on a new novel. But anyway, all that to one side. So that's another personality. Who I got to meet in 85, 86, 87, back in the province. So I ended up going up to Ottawa. Thanksgiving Day I arrived, 1987. And really worked hard. It was wonderful working for Howard. He was he was very demanding, but also very supportive. Howard was a very interesting guy to work for, partly because he was from the Black community, historical Black community in Southern Ontario. At the time I was working for him, he was the only Black member of Parliament. But at the same time, he also had an extraordinary career as a professor, as a biochemist. He was head of the biology department at the University of Windsor. He'd been a professor for 25 years. He published 45 scientific articles. So as an academic, as a scholar, he was, as a scientist, he was a great model. He was also a wonderful orator, something which I think he inherited out of the Black community, and also very, very committed to human rights. I mean, I met the Dalai Lama. Dalai Lama came to meet us because Howard is one of his strongest supporters in the House of Commons, right? I was only mad he didn't give me one of his scarves. Gave Howard one of his scarves, but not me. And also, Howard was able to get along with people from all the other parties. We had a Tory member, actually, I think it was the Assistant Speaker of the House at the time, had an office right across the corridor from us, Marcel Denis. He was a really wonderful guy to work with. Warren Allman, liberal, who was still there as an MP, was excellent as a liberal. Joe Clark was great. Joe Clark was wonderful. He was very supportive of Howard. Here's Howard's a third-party member. And because of knowing Howard's interest in Africa, which he'd never visited, never seen, Joe Clark arranged for Howard, because Joe Clark was Minister of External Affairs, he arranged for Howard to go to Africa at least twice, if not thrice. And on one of those trips, to represent Canada in a meeting with Nelson Mandela. You know, this is, and of course, Mandela we met, and Gorbachev when he visited. I mean, it was, but it wasn't all like that. I have to say, it was not all like that. There were a lot of very dull and boring kinds of days. And also a great sense of frustration, at least for me, because, for instance, we do all this firework expressing our opposition to free trade and the GST. They still became law. I mean, it's a frustrating thing because it's almost like a game. I mean, it is a game. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's there I was working on these things. We're always writing back to our constituents saying, damn GST, awful free trade agreement, blah, 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 blah. Hey, they're law. You know, like, I know this is like simple, fundamental, easy stuff, but it was still grating. After a while, it just got to be really grating. Like, how can we build up all kinds of enthusiastic anger about the GST or about free trade when they're going to become law anyway? The government's got the numbers, so they're going to pass it. And we've been like hooting and hollering. I shouldn't say that. I mean, we're doing, it's important work. And sometimes the government backpedals or changes a few things, and this is good. And I'm glad there's somebody there to do it. But I have to say, after I left to do my PhD at Queens, I will never go back to anything political in that sort. Because it's just, unless you're in government, it is frustrating. But to come back to something else, Joe Clark was really good. In fact, one of the other nice things about, I mean, I have to say, I'm one of the few Canadian poets to have a launch on the Hill. Because Howard, as a member, could, of course, arrange for rooms to be made available for public events. And so he decided to have a launch for me for Wild Falls. So I had a launch on the Hill. And several MPs came, and Joe Clark came, and bought a copy of Wild Falls. And, and of course, I went through the 1988 free trade election in Windsor. I went down, and I was there for 49 days, Windsor, Ontario, fighting in the trenches. It was a big moment. It was a wonderful moment. Of the years I was on the Hill, that was the best moment because we actually did make a difference. Not in the big picture, but in the small picture, we did. We kept our seat. I kept my job. Howard kept his job. But that was a big small victory because, as you may know or remember, the Liberals, oh God, look, first of all, they should have won that campaign. They should have won in 1988. If they hadn't had Turner as leader, I think they would have won in 88. First of all the three parties, including the Tories who did win, they had the best campaign. The Liberals had the best campaign. They, the ads, I mean, I'll never forget. I was sitting in Howard's, I spent the whole election campaign living at his house in Tecumseh, a suburb of Windsor. I was there as a canvas organizer, so it was my job to get volunteers out on the streets, knocking on people's doors, trying to get them to vote for Howard. That was my job, and I did it with great enthusiasm, because it really was my job as at stake. And I wasn't ready to go back to Halifax yet, so I was very intent on getting as many volunteers out there as I could, and we were successful. I mean, the nice thing about that campaign was that we were all really convicted. I mean, everybody who was involved in that campaign, we were all seriously interested in trying to stop this free trade agreement. Back then, I was a real Canadian nationalist. I mean, wow. I mean, Maude Barlow had nothing on me. I was like serious nationalist, or Mal Hurtig, nobody. It was like, we got to stop the damn Americans. They're taking over. No, 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 right? And here's the Tories selling out the country. But anyway, that was our rhetoric. But of course, it did play well in Windsor, because it was a Union town, right? CAW, of course, was opposed to it. What I'm trying to get at here was that the feeling was like being in a crusade. It was, and we slept, ate, drank, opposition to free trade, and Howard McCurdy's office. I mean, we knew, because it was Windsor, we knew long before the election was called, I mean, in April or so, the election got called October 1, 88, and we knew 6 months beforehand that free trade was going to be the number one issue. We knew that. And the party didn't know that. Ed Broadbent didn't know that. Ed Broadbent was accepting this advice saying, people won't trust you on free trade, so don't talk about it. And we could not believe it. When the election got called, the day Maroney called the election, October 1, 88, Ed Broadbent got up and made a statement that didn't mention the free trade agreement. Nobody could believe that. The unions couldn't believe it. Howard couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. Nobody could believe that. I mean, what on earth was he thinking? We knew that this was going to be the defining wedge issue of the campaign. It was clear. And so what we had done, I mean, it was embarrassing. The NDP Federal Office, Ottawa, had made up all this stuff that was going to ride on Ed's popularity, because he was like Uncle Ed. He'd hit 40% in the polls in popularity in the summer of 87, but that was a whole year ago, right? And so the party had prepared all this stuff based on their polling and advice, bad advice as it turned out, that people wanted to be reassured that Ed was going to be the leader, a good guy, because they couldn't be sure about all those other NDP types. But Ed was okay. He had a good credibility factor. So they made up all these posters featuring Ed Broadbent, rolled up sleeves, sort of like summer barbecue mode, smiling, very friendly, affable, avuncular, absolutely. And this was the party stuff that we were getting, that they sent down to us. We threw it all out. We just threw that stuff out. Forget about it. We put up posters with Howard. He had a black and white picture from 1984, which we got blown up, and it was him pointing, like one of those Uncle Sam poses. Uncle Sam once, and it was like that, like this kind of accusatory pointing mode. And we had that plastered all over our campaign office, because we knew free trade was going to be the issue. And when we brought out our literature, that's what it was about. I was in charge of the literature. Big maple leaves. We knew that was going to, so we put a big maple leaves, right? Liberals had, we had bigger maple leaves, you know.
They were orange, but we had
a black maple leaf, for crying out loud, because we put out one black and white, and it was extremely popular. We put out a black and white pamphlet that was actually that photograph of Howard. And it was mainly a black photograph. So then the writing on it was in reverse, in white. And it was 10 reasons why free trade is awful or no good. I forget exactly how the slogan went, but 10 reasons. And so you'd have the picture of Howard pointing, right? And then inside, you had the explanation of the 10 reasons why it was bad. And then on the back cover, big black Canadian maple leaf, right? Flag kind of design. And like, more information, call this number. Come by our office. We had people coming in left and right. We defeated Shaughnessy Cohen. We defeated Shaughnessy Cohen. We defeated the whole liberal machine in Windsor. We defeated Herb Gray's folks who were overflanking us on either side, right? But we had to, because, I mean, we were just more passionate than anybody else was on that issue, that campaign. And we had a real crusade. We had every type of person imaginable coming into our office and working for us. In fact, I still remember I had an interview, so to speak, with one former communist. Or maybe she still was a member of the Communist Party of Canada. And she came in and she worked for us. We had the judge, Marjorie Bowker in Alberta, put out all that stuff about how free trade was a bad deal. It was ridiculous, but it was like going to war. Being in a campaign is like going to war. It really is. You go there, you do your 49 days, 7-week campaign. And we had a great campaign manager. Ron Varley was a steel worker. And of course, that was another element of this thing. I'd never really worked that closely with working class people who were unionized in that way. I mean, because these guys are organized. So these guys are like flying pickets, you know. They would, like the CAW guys would come in and go out. You'd have the steelworker guys come in and go out. And, you know, like do like a blitz of an area of the city or area of the riding and that kind of thing. It was exciting. And we had like the school kids all go out one Saturday. They all came in, they all went out, you know, and that was great, you know, and But I still remember the liberals again. I think they had a great campaign. I never forget. I was sitting in Howard's den watching the television he had there with him. We were two of us were sitting there watching the news. And the first liberal ad came on the free trade agreement. The first one came on. These two guys sitting at a table and they're racing the line, the border between Canada and the U.S., right? Because they're negotiating free trade. And then one of the guys, the American guy, says, well, you forgot one thing, and starts erasing the border, right? And then when that scene finishes, you see the liberal insignia come up. You know, of course, designed like the Canadian flag, the L with the maple leaf in the middle. And then there was this kettle drum. You know, oh, God. It was like the CNN war in the Gulf kettle drums. I mean, this was... Howard jumped up and screamed, there goes my seat. I fell on the floor. I mean...
There goes my job.
There goes my job. It was a great ad. It was a fantastic ad. It was great. The only problem they had was they had Turner. That's their problem. Who could believe that Turner, who used to direct 15 corporations, is anti-free trade? Come on, right? Like, you know, it was going to be easy for the Tories as to do as they did, to bomb the bridge. But I still point out, 6 million people voted for other parties, you know, and a lot of those 6 million were voting against free trade. 5 million voted for the Tories. Okay, they won, but the majority of the people did not vote for them. I know that's the way the system works, first past the post. But still, I mean, in Windsor, we won. We won, you know, and it's just too bad that the party hadn't been able to really organize properly around that issue, you know. It was heartbreaking, and so I remember, and I didn't even want to hear the results until I got to the hall that we were using for the, you know, hopefully victory party, and somebody asked when I walked in. I'd been deliberately staying away, hanging around a beach in Windsor at night. And then finally somebody drove me over, and I wasn't sure whether we had won or lost. And I walked in, somebody mentioned to me right away, we won. And I'm like screaming with joy. But then the TV's on, and I see the results coming from other parts of the country. And they had already announced a Tory majority, I think, because of Quebec. And
so depressing. Just mad. George, the almost invisible PhD student.
The ghost. Really? The ghost.
Really? He'd, yeah. You'd see this strange figure scuttling in, grabbing a whole pile of mail and vanishing. He was working for, you know, he's busy.
Yeah.
He had a job in Ottawa.
Yeah, that's right.
Which year was this?
Well, I worked for Howard from 87 to 91. But I started, I applied to Queens. I was accepted in the fall of 1990, and I decided to go there. And they didn't have any money for me, because I think they accepted 22 students that year. But there was only funding for 10 or a dozen. I forget exactly the number now. But I was going to get a student loan and go anyway. I really wanted to go. So I went to Howard, and this is another thing. This is another reason why he was so good. I went to Howard, and I said, Howard, I've got to leave. I'd worked there for 3 years at this point, and I said, I got to go. I want to do my PhD, and it's partly because of the fact you have a PhD, and I appreciate you as a black male having done that. I feel I should do that. And he said to me, George, I respect that. Don't quit. Here's what we'll do. You work for me 4 days out of the week. Take Tuesdays off, because Tuesdays are not as a slow news day. Nothing's going on Tuesdays. So you go do your classes on Tuesday, work for me the rest of the week. That was a deal. So that was what happened. So he trimmed my salary by a fifth, and I went to took all my classes on Tuesdays.
Which accounts for the strange selection of courses, I suppose.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. They all had to be on Tuesday.
Oh, okay.
That's the only way to do it. So of course, luckily for me, of course Matthew's class was on Tuesday. That was very helpful. And all I had to do, because I didn't have a car back then, I would rent a car the night before, Monday night, late Monday night, about 7 or 8 o'clock, pick up a car at the Ottawa airport, and then drive down. About 5 o'clock in the morning, I'd leave my house or apartment then in Ottawa and drive down Highway 15 to Queens, park the car in the garage, go do all my classes. First one's Peter Sabers, starting at 8:30 in the morning. And in the last class was, I'm going to forget his name, the fellow who's doing the history of the book, or book production, Ferguson. I think it was Craig Ferguson. Yeah, that was it. But actually, I'm going to double back again, as I've been doing all afternoon here. The thing is, yeah, what was it that impelled me to do this? It was partly working for Howard, but it was also a couple of things that may seem relatively silly. The first thing was I finished my MA thesis on Michael Ondaatje in summer of 89, because I moved to Ottawa, of course, after having started at Dell. And so I was working on it on and off during that time. And Andy Wainwright and Patricia Monk were my, advisors at Dalhousie for it. And I finally finished it and was able to graduate in, November 89. And my mother came to my graduation and at Dalhousie. And when we were there, we saw that the Dal PhD candidates or graduands all had these very nice black velvet, soft velvet looking caps with gold tassels. And my mother turned to me and said, "Georgie, you've got to get one of those."
You're after those tassels.
So I said, "Okay, Mom." So the next year I applied.
It's a good boy.
Yeah. Yeah. Except I was really disappointed. She came to my graduation at Queens, and I was really disappointed.
You didn't get one of those hats.
We didn't have a different hat. Exactly. No gold tassel. She didn't mention it though. I don't think she remembered.
She's too tactful.
Yeah. But she was. I mean, it was great.
The wrong one.
It was great that she came. My aunt came, who I'm also very close to, my mother's side, my mother's sister, her only sister, and her husband, my uncle Rex, is from Jamaica originally, and introduced the whole family to curry back in the early 70s when he and my aunt Joan moved from New York City back to Nova Scotia. So it was really good that they were there, but that was one thing. I was like, okay, my mom will be happy if I could do this. And then the other thing was, I was invited to be on a show, a News World program that was being produced out of Ottawa. And the producer, I was involved. It was a show about police violence and black youth. And the producer asked me to be on the show, okay. And a guy from Toronto who was a freelance writer, but a PhD in history, and the then Solicitor General of Ontario. And I felt I was sort of media savvy, having done a few things before and having been an ex-journalist of sorts. So I didn't have a lot of fear and trepidation about coming on the show. And I did, except I realized when I got on the show, I'm not blaming the producer for this, but it became pretty clear to me, and maybe I should have been less naive, I should have realized right away that I was going to be the token voice of black anger vis-a-vis the Solicitor General. And while the guy who was the history PhD was going to be the voice of reason. And see how I was like, we're going to have a debate here. You're going to be this and you're going to be that. And the Solicitor General will be taking on both of you. That was really how the thing had been set up. But I hadn't quite understood that. I thought I was just going to get on. I don't know what I was thinking. But anyway, as far as I was concerned, the show did not go well, at least not for me, because I felt I was being boxed in. And certainly, the positions that the attorney or Solicitor General was taking really reinforced it, because that's how he perceived me. All he had to see was my black face, and then it was like, okay, you're an unreasonable, irrational, angry, firebomb-throwing guy, so I'm going to have to take you seriously. And that was the kind of attitude that I was getting from him. And I couldn't understand that, because I was thinking, why can't we have a reasonable conversation? The police are bullies. Let's start with that, okay? But anyway, it wasn't. But the guy who had the PhD was always being like referred back to with some, condescension, but rather they're giving him some authority and saying, "Well, what do you think of this? You have the historical perspective." And he'd say, "Well, yes, the RCMP massacred Native people, and so it's no surprise that the Toronto police killed black youth." And it was like nobody could say anything back to that. So I was saying, this, and of course he was the doctor so and so on the screen, and I was George L. A. Clark, just nothing, right? And I was thinking, I don't want to be positioned like this anymore. This is ridiculous. All right, this guy's getting... And then, after the show was over, the producer came up to him and said, "Is your hotel okay?" And I'm like, okay, I lived in Ottawa, so okay, I guess I don't come in for a hotel. But I had to make my own way to the studio. So then I'm like saying, what about my taxi? But I just thought, like, hey, I'm getting a different standard of treatment here. And so I thought, stupidly, naively, having a PhD might just be the thing to, you know, just get slightly better treatment here, you know. So that was another reason. That was also 1989. And that was another reason why I said, okay, enough's enough. I've got to get this little piece of paper too, so that next time I get on television, they can say, doctor, blah, blah, blah. And I have just a little bit more authority than I have as poet, or as just myself. Now, you know, that thinking is bogus, I confess. But that's one of the reasons, one of the other reasons, one of my other motivations for wanting to go on and do that degree. So, anyway, that's how that came about. But I, you know, I'm going to double back again and talk about writing, because going back to Halifax, 85, 86, I end up working in black community, end up getting all these other influences, and doing writing that now I feel has some resonance with the community, because I can read these poems back to people and they can say, I understand that, I know those people you're talking about, that's the way we speak, etc., etc. And that was really strong, really powerful for me. And but the real turnaround came in April 1986. The Black Cultural Center had a fundraiser, and it was 3 years old, and they were raising funds still, and they said to, and I was invited as one of the local artists to perform. And perform is the word here. I mean, they were, everybody else on the program was a real performer, a dancer, an actor, a singer, a musician, something like that. And I was the token poet on the program. And so there was an audience of roughly about 300 people, mainly black, mainly people I knew growing up in Halifax and everything else. And it was at the Rebecca Cohn Auditorium in Dalhousie. And I'll never forget it. It was a Friday night. I go, and my first book was published, 1983, Saltwater Spirituals. And so I'm a real poet. I've got a book, right? So I get up there, and I've been taught to read poetry at the University of Waterloo. So I get up there and I start reciting poems, or reading poems, not reciting, reading poems from Saltwater Spirituals that deal with black history, for crying out loud, in the province. And people started yelling at me, get off the stage, this is boring, oh man, when are you going to stop, this is awful, you know, stuff like that. So of course I was devastated. Here's my single calling card, my one claim to hopeful fame, and everybody's saying they don't want to hear it, right? And so I was like, really bombing badly. If they'd had tomatoes, rotten fruit, I would have been plastered with the stuff, because everybody else was a performer and I wasn't performing. I really, in a sense, literally was not performing for my own audience, my own home audience. So luckily I had a piece that's in Wild Falls called Love Letter for an African Woman. I'd just written it and I started to read that, and then the place, the auditorium, started to get quiet, and then people started yelling, preach it, amen, testify, that's it, you're home now, stuff like that. And like a total reversal of the reception I'd been getting up to that point. And when I finished that piece, there was, oh, really rich applause, rich, lush applause. And I knew at that moment I would never write anything else again that I could not read before my community. That was like, okay, fine, I understand that I have to have, there has to be a performative aspect, because if you want to talk about black aesthetics, that's part of our aesthetic. That is part and parcel of our cultural survival. And I understand that to be inside that aesthetic is a necessity if you want to have any kind of black audience. I know Emner Bazy Phillip talks about this in one of her essays in the collection of essays. Genealogy of Resistance. Yeah. Thank you. And she makes exactly this point, and in a way that's really honest and personal. She confesses, and I think that's the right verb to use here. She confesses in those essays that her largest audience consists of white women. And she also goes on to say that she wishes she had more black readers, but that she understands that she won't have more black readers unless she has more of a performance aspect in her work. And that one of the liberating things for her was when she was reading from her great book, She Tries Her Tongue, The Language Softly Breaks. When she ended up hearing a reading of that done as a kind of dramatic performance, two or three voices reading. As you know, the book is a mishmash of typography and poems slanted down one side of the page and then cross another side of the page and so on. So how do you read that? You can only read it as a polyphonous performance. It is, that's what it is. Piece has to come with some kind of passion involved and some kind of giving of oneself to the audience. And not just a stand back recitation, but rather something that is really engaged, a presentation that really tries to speak to with the audience. And so it was a humbling moment, and I'm glad I had it. You know, I'm really glad I had to go through that. And in a sense, why shouldn't I have had to go through that? If I'd been a musician, I like to use this as an example. If I'd been a musician, any kind of musician or any kind of singer, I would have had those kinds of audience reactions long before I got in front of that particular audience. People would have been telling me, that was good, you sang well, or you didn't sing well, or you played well, you didn't play well. No one feels they have to hold back for a performance. They'll let you know right away, no matter what kind of audience it is, that was good or it wasn't good, or it was so-so, or what have you. You know right away. But for some reason, when it comes to hearing writers read, we don't tend to apply the same kind of demand or standard. Or people, even if they feel bored, they'll just clap and go away quietly.
There's no expectation that there is a real performative element to that. It's just hearing the writer read their work.
Exactly. And in some ways, that's fair. Sure. Why not? Because the writer only has to write. He or she doesn't need to perform. Mm-hmm. The writing is the performance. And so I agree with that. On the other hand, I don't want to be reductive here, but I don't feel that many black audiences are going to have that point of view.
Or many audiences, period.
I actually think it's something that a lot of audiences are being taught to suppress because they would like to hear a real performance. I actually think it's just something that's somehow been suppressed.
It's high culture theater or something. Mm.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's it. But I know that for my community, you really have to come with something that people are going to feel that they want to hear. Not necessarily. I don't mean to the extent that you tailor your message to the audience
They're used to hearing interesting language, and they don't want to hear boring language.
Thank you. That's a very good way to put it. I mean, and it goes back to the church, because the ministers, the deacons, etc., etc., are going to give spontaneous performances, and they have to. You know, one of the good things about living in Durham, Gita and I went to Black American Church. In fact, a Baptist church that Martin Luther King had preached in when he was coming through that area, White Rock Baptist Church. In the black part of Durham, and the fellow who preaches there,